Yeah, there's nothing to say about this really, other than that. other than that, it's a bit of a companion piece to Andrew's paper. So they sort of wrote themselves together in a sense, which was a really pleasant experience. This paper will consider how reading poetry happens in network culture. Oh, that was upside down. It will ask what constitutes both a poem and its reading in a moment defined by complex mediatic assemblages and their interactions in or as contemporary life. My interest is in things that feel like poems but do not necessarily self-identify that way, media works in which language is central and in which the emergence of a text in time and for a reader is the signal activity. This interest is in part to do with a long-term inquiry into expanded or extended writing practices, writing that happens in extra-literary contexts and from which diverse modes of reading take place. It's also in part to do with the persistent alliance between poetry and code, where code is taken in its computational sense, that is, to use Florian Kramer's definition, as a transformation rule for symbols into action. And I should just say that from now on, when I talk about code, I'm talking about it in that computational sense rather than more generally, although the resonance is there in its more general sense. My argument is therefore twofold. First, that poetry is an instructive and productive modality with which to read contemporary language-intensive media works. Second, that this is related to and ultimately problematises a colloquial tendency to collate poetry and code. And you see this all the time in the way code is taught to students. Creative coding is taught via, I guess, poetry exercises and in things like WordPress's tagline, which is poetry is code. And I talk about this elsewhere, but no time today. Drawing on Kramer's notion of post-digital literature and Wendy Chun's interventions into software studies and the digital humanities, I will posit that poetry has long been associated with computational logic, and that today the reading of both poems and non-poems involves an intimacy with and implication in computational processes and machinic assemblages. So poetry has always desired to be computational, and now that we have actual computers, that fact can only inform and reinscribe our reading of poetry. So specifically today, I'll discuss a work by the Sydney-based media artist Monica Monin called Conversation Theory, which was recently installed as a single-piece installation at First Draft in Woolloomooloo. The gallery is small, square and windowless. In the centre of the room, two flat screens are installed using conspicuous metal black poles and grips that run from the ceiling to the floor. The screens are suspended in close proximity, facing each other, with the mounts forming a considerable infrastructure in concert. One screen displays images, collaged and partly overlaid in groups of various sizes. These images are cropped, poor quality, obscure. They are, to use Hito Steele's term, poor images, ripped and compressed files associated with the perpetually distributed and mostly deauthored pictures that comprise the internet's ever-swelling archive. The second screen displays text, white on a black background, centre justified. The screens change in turn, responding to each other. In one exchange, the text screen displays two sentences in a single line, soft, a gesture. The image screen replies with a constellation of pixelated crops showing people giving the thumbs up hand symbol. The conversation continues in this way indefinitely. In this work, an ordinary thing is occurring. Two programs are reading each other's data, exchanging bodies of code in order to make something happen. What is less ordinary is the setup, which both makes this exchange its subject while also resisting the desire to fully represent it. The viewer engages with computation in time and space, and crucially as an artwork, and yet does not see the computation in its nuanced operations. If much media work engages with code in order to visualise information, Monin's practice is interested in code itself, but in order to show that computation is co-productive of its data and never merely an operation to carry it. In the briefest possible gloss, digital humanities refers to a recent-ish field of practice with the aim of reconciling humanities approaches to theory, scholarship and pedagogy in the information age and through the use of emergent forms or systems of media and technology. Though this list is inexhaustive, digital humanities approaches include the following: thinking about the way that computation, networked systems and so-called big data methods can be used in the study and analysis of the humanities and humanities subjects, developing practices for the writing, publishing, distributing and archiving of electronic and or digital materials, including individual works and entire archives, figuring a critical vocabulary for issues around literacy, access, pedagogy and so on in the age of computer-reliant media and education. At its core, the digital humanities is concerned with finding ways to understand, both in the sense of interpret as well as feel related to, the growing digital infrastructure as a system for knowledge production, both in the humanities and more generally speaking. Natalia Cecilia and Wendy Chun highlight the enthusiasm that DH practitioners have for doing, making, building, hacking and networking, activities that are imagined in stark contrast to the more static and introspective clichés that follow the humanities scholar, sitting, thinking, theorise, conversing. This emphasis is translated, as Cecilia tracks, into a split between theory and practice. If the humanities is about theory, then the digital humanities is about practice. Or if the humanities is about saying, then the digital humanities is about doing. Against this perceived split, Cecilia and Chun make the similar point. If the digital humanities is to be taken seriously, then it is because it can tell us something important about the way that knowledge production and transfer occurs in network culture. And in knowing clearer how knowing happens, a critical approach to the processes that inhere as theorising, practising, saying, doing, making and unmaking can be developed. Moreover, these critical approaches can then be engaged in order to call into question some of the unchecked assumptions about how media and technology articulate social, cultural and political life. To say it differently, many digital humanists wonder how technology can save, update and operationalise the humanities. But for Cecilia and Chun, and certainly for me, the question ought to be how the humanities can properly account for and hold accountable the complexity of technology. For, it seems too obvious to point out, technology and humans co-produce each other. Florian Kramer's work on post-digital literature references the experimental musician and sound artist Kim Cascone, who in 2000 used the term post-digital to describe, quote, a certain type of electronic music which made playful use of technical glitches and was cheaply produced on laptop computers, end quote. Kramer's use of the term in relation to literature builds on the key points in Cascone's definition. Electronic, that is digital in its colloquial sense. Literature, that engages reflexively and knowingly, if not straight up playfully, with the functions and dysfunctions of new media technologies, and that are self-produced using soft and hardware typical to home computers and personal devices. He goes further too in describing an aesthetic that drives post-digital literature, an ambivalent affect that toggles between disenchantment and fascination with technology, manifest as an awareness of the already historical status of the digital in the age of network culture, or what Luciana Parisi calls cybernetic capitalism, and a refutation of the supposed dichotomy between analogue and digital systems. For, as Kramer writes, analogue and digital processing have coexisted long before computers, since they refer merely to different ways of organising information. Today, they coexist to produce complex assemblages that include old and new technology and that move between physical and virtual, actual and speculative modalities as a matter of basic function. So the post-digital might refer to a number of things, certain kinds of aesthetic objects and texts, an ambivalence towards technology manifest as a style, a way of understanding the rapid historicisation of our contemporary moment into micro-eras of technological progress. And thinking about it in relation to the digital humanities, the concept of post-digital literature, to follow Kramer, suggests a number of things about contemporary reading practices. It acknowledges that literature has been interested in issues of automation, mechanisation, recombination, self-organisation and algorithmic composition for as long as it has existed. This has occurred at different moments and for different reasons as a way of understanding the relation between language and divinity or between language and non-human machines. It acknowledges further that in our contemporary moment, writing cannot be read cannot be written nor read without recourse to network culture in some manner, whether directly or indirectly. This includes processes and systems of composition, publishing, researching, archiving, printing, distributing, performing, collating, and so on, as well as the more embodied and implicit effects of digital culture on thinking, reading, writing, and interpreting. Per the historical poetics ethos, the concept of the post-digital emphasises the historical conditioning of the contemporary without firstly assuming that shared concerns translate to long-term or trans-historical values in any simple sense, and secondly, assuming that models of reading and writing can be thought apart from what mediates them in a given context. Kramer's book-length survey of proto- and post-digital literatures, Words Made Flesh, concentrates, as expected, on poetry, a form that, above all, emphasises form itself as a lively and indeed living material that becomes in the co-productive acts of composition and reading, brought together in time and for a duration. The title of Monin's work is derived from Gordon Pask, who in the middle of the 20th century posited conversation theory as a critical concept for cybernetics. As a concept, cybernetics has been in circulation since Plato, but in its more contemporary sense it refers to a science developed by Norbert Wiener in the 1940s that describes relationships of communication and control, the direction and application of communication, between humans and non-humans, most often computers. Pask's conversation theory states that knowledge is produced in cybernetic systems through interaction. Indeed, intelligence, whether human or machine, is the accumulation of knowledge produced through such interaction. As Luciana Parisi writes in his conversation theory, Pask, quote, lists the reasons why principles of agreement, understanding, and consciousness are crucial for the devising of human-to-human, human-to-computer, and computer-to-computer interactions. Away from the on-off logic of computation, Pask conceives of interaction as a conversation that requires mutual actions, such as those performed in dance, where space is offered to the steps of other bodies. Pask's model already foresaw that information transfer and data structures were the new platforms for the future of computational architecture. He was not concerned with inputting information into a body, but rather with showing that the interactive qualities of agreement, understanding, and consciousness were emergent properties of enacted environments. Parisi's reading of Pask takes the ordinary articulation of conversation theory, a model about how knowledge comes to be known in the act of coming to knowledge through interaction, that is, a radical constructivist model of learning and knowing, and moves into a different space, the space of space itself. Conversation theory becomes, in Parisi's design, a way of acknowledging the architectural dimension of relationality, the way that relations open up and inhabit literal spaces of encounter in which and from which intelligence emerges and is mobilised. For Monin, Parisi's Pask offers an ideal model for a work in which two discrete bodies of code engage in a conversation that renders the emergence of a mutually implicated and collective intelligence on the screens as they read and respond to each other's information perpetually. Crucially, the information comes from diverse sources, several databases, some human and some AI written. These databases were vetted by Monin to remove sexist and racist language. Finally, a program that allows the two bodies of code to draw on their respective databases was written, using keyword and syntax rules as the logic of response. The responses shown on the two screens are the result of complex modulations, moving one body of code through a series of different translations and transductions to arrive as legible to a second body of code. These transductive processes are central to computation. Computation, in a sense, is this process of entangled translation at the level of code encountering other code and executing, or not, various commands. But, as Monin argues in her own writing on this work, the operations of computation are almost entirely nonsensible. They cannot be perceived outside of their effects. Conversation theory is thus not interested in trying to metaphorically or performatively restage this computational process, as, for example, a data visualization approach might do, but rather to invite the viewer into a space in which their reading experience becomes implicated in a vast network of intelligent exchanges that, though mutually productive, are not able to know the exact operations of the other. the knowing that occurs both in the conversation between the bodies of code and in the viewer who watches the exchange happen are irreducible to each other, and though they contribute to the same networked assemblage in which they are all integral, they are incomparable as forms of knowledge and non-equivalent in their agency. If computation is imperceptible to humans, then this work is about resisting the urge to make the imperceptible perceptible through representation or analogy. Instead, it offers a space for the consideration of non-sensible dimensions in a sensible world. Or it offers a space for the consideration of knowledge as something that always and necessarily includes unknowable and unthinkable things. Exemplarity is more often than not described in terms of a movement between the particular and the general. Cases of the real, writes John Froh, who's sitting right in that chair there. It's recording, so I'm putting him in the room. Cases of the real, writes John Froh, proposed in such a way that certain more general conclusions can be drawn from their peculiar features. An example, therefore, points outside itself by showing its singularity as an index of a diverse multiplicity. Agamben, for whom this example is a central motif, writes, and you've heard this already today, in any context where it exerts its force, the example is characterized by the fact that it holds for all cases of the same type, and at the same time, it is included among these. In literary criticism and literary studies, an example is more or less mandatory. It is hard to make claims about a text without referring to its content, as it is hard to make claims about textuality more generally without referring to this or that text. But of course, an example can cause a certain amount of anxiety. Can one line of a poem speak to the poem as a whole? Can one poet speak to a generation, or one generation to a form, or one author to a national literature, and so on? Can an example be expected to support both a close reading of its text and a higher level abstraction of that text into a set of concepts that could be mobilised elsewhere? And what happens to the example after it has been used to shift a particular into a general? How, for example, does Klee's Angelus Novalis live on as a painting when its citational nightlife is so dominant as Benjamin's signature figure? In an earlier work of mine on Gertrude Stein, I struggled with the problem of the example. In that study, I argued that Stein's writing is directed towards the reading experience. Reading something that fiddles with grammar and narrative logic in a way that makes the reading focused on the local conditions of the sentence or line or paragraph at hand, and as such that makes the techniques of reading as a cognitive process or as an imaginative experience apparent, makes the reading experience finally productive of an ad hoc theory of reading itself. In other words, reading Stein's work is productive of a theory of reading more generally. So because in this sense Stein's work is already an example of how to read other texts and how to appreciate the operations of reading, citing examples from Stein seems difficult, if not redundant. But the bigger question is to do with whether an example would be sufficient to prove, as it were, that knowledge had been produced in an encounter with a certain Stein work or part of a Stein work. The business of literary studies is to link reading and knowledge, however figured. My argument that knowledge occurs in the act of reading and is directed towards itself can hardly be verified in writing. I was apprehensive about staging instances in which my real-time reading could be performatively tuned into writing. I was equally nervous to make a claim that was unable to be justified, not least because this research was for a PhD, a genre that requires one to be explicit about the claim being made and about its reproducibility as a quantum of knowledge. Encountering Monin's work for the first time, I was immediately reminded of Stein's Tender Buttons, a three-part prose poem in a pseudo-novella in which objects, spaces and concepts act as titles for short texts written in repetitive declarative sentences, very roughly X is Y and X is not Z statements in recombinatory syntactical forms and with a diverse but colloquial vocabulary. The narrative tension, if you like, in Tender Buttons comes from the awkward relationship between their titles and their poems. The reading is prone to diagnostic or detective sensibilities, wondering if, and if so how, the title is represented by the text. The joke, of course, is that any relation is possible if one reads like a conspiracy theorist, and the relations may be intentional or not, conscious or not, associative or not, arbitrary or not, In any case, one gets the sense that it doesn't matter because they will always be contingent and emergent and then therefore cannot in good faith speak to a higher reason outside the poem. Stein's gift, in a sense, with Tender Buttons is to offer to paranoid reading, is to offer up paranoid reading as an antidote to paranoia, as a general state. Because after paranoia, a more generative approach to perceiving relations can be made, one in which the title and the poem co-implicate each other, but in the spirit of non-reciprocity and non-equivalence. Monin's conversation theory implicates the reader in a relation that both includes and excludes their presence. It includes the reader by making legible two sets of information, image and text, in an alternating responsive feedback that the reader can follow by standing closely to the two screens and by craning the neck from one to the other. And it excludes the reader by failing to visualise or metaphorise the processes through which each body of information comes into being. The computation remains imperceptible, the text screen an index of this, rather than an attempt to approximate or simulate what is occurring at the level of transduction and translation. The result is a textual assemblage in which an explicit material experience, the body in a room in which two screens show a seemingly infinite supply of information, is productively problematized by an implicit experience of obscurity, both in the sense of an uncertain center or a point or point of meaning, and in the sense of being only partially available. Obscurity, as Daniel Tiffany has argued, is native to poetry's ontology, and the madeness or artifice, to use Veronica Forrest Thompson's word, that's for all you Cambridge people in the audience, of poetry in its signal gesture of drawing attention to the acts of writing and reading in their co-implication means that poetry is constantly in a state of denaturalising itself, preventing itself from settling into mere fact. This denaturalisation requires a sense of what cannot be known or said and yet which manifests in thought and language regardless, a choice void. Conversation theory thus directs the reader towards an obscurity that remains properly obscure, and in doing so, the reader experiences a text that emerges, related, though not equivalent, to the obscurity of its own processes. In this sense, reading this work is as if reading a poem, and subsequently, reading it as if a poem means reading the work as resonant, not for its reference, but for its composition, its having been made and its coming to be. Thanks.